I make no promises, but I'm going to try to get to the end of chapter 2. We'll just see how that goes. Are you ready? Chapter 2, the book of Daniel. Daniel, remember, was taken as a teenager, very likely, perhaps early 20s, but likely a teenager. When Nebuchadnezzar came in, just like Jeremiah prophesied, oh, by the way, Moses told them that was going to happen. If they didn't listen to what God is saying and obey his word, he would bring a nation singular. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 28, right around verse 49. A nation. And here it is. The Babylonians have come. They're going to lay three sieges. The first one, they leave a vassal Jewish king behind. Promise to behave. Oh, yeah, we promise. And then false prophets sidle up to that vassal king, a son of Josiah, and they whisper, "We're not even supposed to be here." And he believes them, and he acts up, and so Nebuchadnezzar has to come a second time. The second siege is when Ezekiel is taken back to Babylon. Another vassal king is installed with a hearty promise, "Oh, we will not, you know, disobey you, King Nebuchadnezzar, we promise." And then that king gets to listening to the false prophets, and then king has to come back the third time, Nebuchadnezzar, and that third time is when he destroys the temple and Jerusalem. So here we are in chapter 2. Are you ready? By the way, Nebuchadnezzar's dad is a guy with an equally cool name, Nabopolassar. Awesome. And about the last 2 years or so of Nabopolassar's life, Nebuchadnezzar, his son, traveled with him in a powerful campaign to expand the kingdom. And the other big guy on the block would be across the way. That would be the Pharaoh of Egypt. And so Nabopolassar and his son Nebuchadnezzar take off after Pharaoh Necho. They will eventually meet up and tangle at the Carchemish, and Nabopolassar dies somewhere early in that campaign, and so Nebuchadnezzar now takes over. And so he is on his way, and then that's when he stops by there in Jerusalem and lays siege. And by the way, the book of Jeremiah has all the details as well. But here we are, chapter 2, verse 1. Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, we're going to call this about 604 B.C., thereabouts. Nebuchadnezzar takes command of the Babylonian armies during the last year of his father's life. And he defeats, as I said, Mr. Pharaoh Necho at Carchemish in 605 B.C., and that solidifies really the first world empire. Some people refer to Nebuchadnezzar and following as the Neo-Babylonian Empire because there was another sort of startup with an older Babylonian, not an empire, nearly as expensive as Nebuchadnezzar. But that was Hammurabi, about 600 years in front of Nebuchadnezzar. Some of you might remember from those dusty old history books, Hammurabi's Code, a codification or writing down of the rules. And as you know, for many monarchies, well, what's the law? Well, it's what I feel it is. And so the goalposts often would move around. Hammurabi is known that he wrote down his civil legal system, and so then that superseded even Hammurabi himself. And that was really a first in many respects in Western civilization, because after all, what could the king do? Whatever he wanted, until Hammurabi wrote it down, and inferring that even the king was not above the law. That's how Hammurabi is famous. That was your first sort of empire, but the Neo-Babylonian Empire is the new one, and that's going to be huge. And as I said last time, Hammurabi was Chaldean. He was Semitic, so he comes from the same Semitic people or background even as the Jewish people to some degree. And he was descended from Nimrod. Remember what Nimrod's name means? I will rebel. Talk about wearing a name badge of what you're going to do. That was Nimrod. And remember in Genesis 10, he founds the city of Babel. Babylon becomes a greater understanding, Tower of Babel, etc., etc. Well, Hammurabi and ultimately Nebuchadnezzar That was their great, 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 great granddaddy. Also, we're going to see in the story starting tonight, the Magi. Today, in our society, a magician is sort of, they don't hold a very, imposing sort of understanding. But in this day, they were huge. These were the astrologers and the power brokers of the civil society. They claimed to have such supernatural wherewithal and shwammy that if you got one of them upset with you, they would just do the mojo on you, and then who knows what terrible luck and terrible things would happen. And remember, too, every portion of modern occultic practice can be traced back here. So it was no small thing when the Magi would say to you, I'm going to put the shwammy on you, and today would be, right. But in those days, it was very effective because they had this ability to manipulate demons through spells and incantations. And so it was no small thing. So the Magi were the power brokers. And evidently they held a great sway with Nebuchadnezzar's father. Well, Nabopolassar is now gone. And so now we're going to have a change of administration. And so there's going to be a jockeying of position to have the ear of the king. And who's going to get caught up in that drama is going to be Daniel. Like I said, Nebuchadnezzar inherits his father's staff of the Magi and the priests and the astrologers. He's wondering, I wonder who's truly loyal to me and which one are sort of just looking to be, you know, kind of kiss up to me and then do what they want to do and maybe even usher in perhaps possibility of another leader. So he's going to be very careful. And so Nebuchadnezzar comes up with an interesting, Chuck Missler used to call, executive development program. And Daniel's going to be a part of that. So now we're in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Nebuchadnezzar had dreams in his spirit and was so troubled that his sleep left him. Verse 2. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans. Those would be your ethnic sort of Babel people. To tell the king his dreams. So they came and they stood before the king. Verse 3. And the king said to them, I've had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. It's going to be Daniel's supernatural interpretation that's going to set him apart. But also, we got to have a heads up, because when we're going to see at the end, by the end of the chapter, God is going to show us and King Nebuchadnezzar the very backbone of all end times Bible prophecy. I got some slides for you here in just a little bit. And the framework, of course, for the book of Revelation. If you don't get Daniel correct, it's easy to go astray wandering the fields of the book of Revelation. Verse 4. Well, then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. Most of us know that the vernacular of Jesus' day there in Jerusalem was Aramaic. And likely Jesus spoke Aramaic like everybody did. It's a little known fact that they learned Aramaic, the Jews did, in Babylon. Aramaic has its roots with the Chaldeans. And so we're going to see, if we read the language, we would be reading in Hebrew chapter 1. But then when we get to chapter 2 in the original language, chapters 2 through 7 are written in Aramaic. If you've ever wondered about the months on the Jewish calendar, you'll find that those months, their names, Elul, some of the others that are escaping me just now, Nisan and what have you, they are Babylonian in their origin. What? Why do they have months named after Babylonian this and Babylonian that? Because they picked it up here in this 70-year exile. The Jews learned this language during their captivity, and by the time Jesus shows up, it's the common language of the Jewish people. O king, they say, live forever. You know, smooch, 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 kissy, kissy. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give you its interpretation. Verse 5, the king, I don't think so. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm, if you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut into pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap. There's your executive development program. You guys have been making all kinds of bank with your occultic stuff, and you sure have sort of the respect and awe of the people, but I want to know which one of you is the real deal, the real supernatural heavyweight. You tell me what I've dreamed, and then I'll believe that it was supernatural. Now, by the way, and if you can't do that, I'm going to have you and your family killed. Oh my. Verse 6. However, if you tell me the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. Let's see who's just kissing up to the new king and who has the real supernatural shwami. From the Greek word shemerilius. Verse 7. They answered again. They said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation. Yeah, is there an echo in here? Didn't you hear me, guys? Verse 8. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time because you see that my decision is firm. Stop stalling, you guys. Verse 9. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me. Talking about, I know what your game was with my father. Until the time has changed, now I'm on the throne. And we're going to find out which one of you is the real deal and not. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. Verse 10. Well, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there's not a man on earth that can tell the king's matter. I wrote my margin, right? Wouldn't that be supernatural? It surely would. Supernatural, beyond the natural. Metaphysical, beyond the physical. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. There's no precedent for it, king. Verse 11. And it is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. In my margin, I'm all, bingo. Nebuchadnezzar wants to know who he can trust. And these priests and magi were politically powerful and culturally famous and rich because of their spiritual pick a card, any card, so to speak. There truly is supernatural power in tarot cards, Ouija boards, calling on spirits and spells. There really is significant, those are open doors. The devil doesn't care if you want to use a crystal ball, tea leaves, reading lines in your hand, anything to prognosticate the future. The devil's all will inhabit it, doesn't matter. But what they are, those are open doors. And a lot of this was happening here in Babylon. So I wanted to make a quick notation here. That's one of the reasons why God says stay away from it. Because you open up your heart or mind to the supernatural without the protection and obedience to God and his word. The enemy will dupe you. Absolutely. And that's why God says stay away from that stuff. The devil will entice with supernatural to deceive. It's like the drug dealer who gives you the first time he gives it to you free because he's going to get you on the comeback. And that's what the enemy does. The enemy does at times literally achieve physical supernatural healings. And then when somebody is supernaturally healed, they're like, whoa. And then whoever was the instrument or the conduit of that healing then leads them astray. And try to tell them that there's not reality in what happened to them. I know that I was sick and I got healed. Can't tell me nothing. So that's why the enemy is nothing to trifle with, to stay away from. You got to stay away from him. The devil's power, however, is limited. The devil can only do supernaturally what the Lord allows him. Watch this, verse 12. And for this reason, the king was angry and very furious and gave the command to destroy all those wise men of Babylon who are going to clean house. Verse 13. So the decree went out and they began killing the wise men. And they, Nebuchadnezzar's soldiers, sought out Daniel and his companions, even though they're from Israel and from Jerusalem. Remember, they've been been raised in the college. So they get lumped in the minds of the guards. So we're going to get them too. Verse 14. Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch. This is one of the soldiers that's going to get him. The captain of the king's guards, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. Verse 15. And he answered and he said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is this decree from the king so urgent? And Arioch made the decision, or that is to say, he told Daniel the whole story. Daniel listens. Now, verse 16. So Daniel went in and he asked the king to give him some time that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and he made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That's the Jewish names. Remember, they got their names changed on chapter 1 to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Verse 18, that they might seek the mercies from God of heaven concerning the secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Daniel's now going to seek the living God who knows everything as if his life depended on it, because it did. Verse 19. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in the night vision, so Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Verse 20. And Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. So God gave Daniel a supernatural understanding, a word of knowledge as to what the king actually dreamed. Verse 21. And he, God, my God, Daniel's God, changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep secrets. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. And I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's demand. Therefore, Daniel, he went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. And he went and he said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Wait a minute. Wouldn't Daniel say, don't destroy me? Notice what he's doing here. This is a model of intercession. Keep this in mind if you have a highlighter. Maybe highlight this. Because he saved their necks. And these are going to be the same guys next week in chapter 3, we're going to try to kill Daniel. Isn't that how it goes? Moses was another model of a great intercessor. And here is Daniel. So don't kill any more of the wise people. He saved their lives. And next week, they're going to come after him. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. So Arioch, verse 25, quickly brought Daniel before the king, and he said thus to him, I found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. So the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, that's his given name in Babylon, or Chaldean, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Do you see that the interpretation wouldn't be as sort of believable if the king had told him the dream? Because, you know, well, maybe. But if Daniel's going to tell him exactly what he did dream, then the king is going to be open to the interpretation. Verse 27. So Daniel answered in the presence of the king, and he said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men and the astrologers, the magicians and the soothsayers, they cannot declare to the king, but there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the latter days. Notice here, Daniel is giving God the glory for his supernatural gifting. what were the Magi doing with their supernatural insight and acumen? They were using it to puff themselves up. Very different from the Magi. I'll tell you what the dream was. Here it is. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed when you were sleeping. And here it is, verse 29. Well, as for you, O king, thoughts came into your mind while you were on your bed about what would come to pass after this. Remember, he's just taken over from his dad. He has just established the first world empire. And evidently, Nebuchadnezzar was concerned or even anxious. Where do I go from here? What's going to happen to this kingdom? He who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be, verse 30. But as for me, the secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living. Nuh-uh. But for our sakes, who make known the interpretation of the king, that you may know the thoughts of your heart. I'm going to tell you some stuff. It's going to be supernatural, but we didn't do it. God did. The true God knew what you were thinking when you were drifting off to sleep. You probably were worrying, what's going to happen to my empire? Verse 31. So you, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This image whose splendor was excellent. It stood before you, and its form was awesome. The image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron. Its feet were partly of iron and partly of clay. Even in this culture, the metallurgy was advanced enough. You can't take iron, especially the iron of this day, and put it around clay. Iron and clay don't mix. The iron will absorb the moisture from the clay substance and will begin to rust. And the iron itself would degrade into nothing, and it is because it was infused into whatever you were doing the clay with. Now there's holes in the clay, and the whole thing's going to fall down. That's the point. Gold and silver and bronze on feet of clay and iron? Well, that's not going to last very long. Verse 34. And then you watched while a stone was cut without hands, which struck the image in its feet of iron and clay and broke them to pieces. And then the iron, the clay, and the bronze, and the silver, and the gold fell over, and then the rock crushed everything, and it became like chaff from the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them away so that there was no trace to be found. Yes, some statue that was. It got pulverized by a rock whose hands, human hands, did not make. And then the stone that struck the image became a great mountain that filled the whole earth. And there's the king. Ding! You did it! That's right! Couple thoughts. Notice the descending value of metals. These are going to be the next four world empires. And here's the key. These will have to do with Israel. Will there be other great empires other than the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans? Mm-hmm. The Mongolian Empire was quite substantial, and there have been others. But these four are going to have to do with Israel specifically. Until this rock, that's going to be Messiah Jesus, smashes them all. That's going to happen in Revelation 19. See, every human adventure in trying to govern himself or itself always ends badly because the people at the top get sort of pleased with themselves, insulated often from morality itself, and they can do whatever they want, and they do, and eventually that kingdom will fall. In Revelation 19, when Jesus comes back to the planet, that's the mountain. And the picture, he's going to smash that whole system of human government that is all predictive of the millennial reign of Christ. Humans have given it their best shot, personal opinion. I think the best government thus far humans have ever come up with is our American Republic, constitutional republic that we have, with a bicameral House and Senate and a judicial branch, supposedly all watching over each other's shoulder. Even America, I believe the greatest government that spawned the greatest economy, military, and safety and security cannot last, and it won't. And by the time we get to the millennial reign of Jesus Christ, all the humans are going to know only the Prince of Peace with perfect justice and overflowing mercy and love. That's the only way that a family of large amounts of people are going to get along with the fruit of the Spirit. That's what this whole exercise is. Jesus is the rock, Messiah. He's going to smash the thing at his feet. It's going to fall over, and it's going to pulverize it and blow away. All a model of the millennial reign of Christ. Verse 36, this is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, you are the king of kings. Nebuchadnezzar, I like where this is going. For the God of heaven has given you this kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the fields and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you a ruler over them all. You, King Nebuchadnezzar, are the king of gold. That's going to go to King's head in a little bit, and he's going to run into some pride problems in chapter 4. But are you ready? Let's go for our first couple of slides. Go ahead. I put this together for you. Go. The Bible says coming up is 4 big old kingdoms. The first one, the head of gold, that's the Babylonian Empire. 605 B.C. to 539 B.C. Why 539? That's when Nebuchadnezzar's knucklehead grandson, Belshazzar, is throwing a party when he should have been fortifying the Babylonian city against Cyrus the Great, and he does it. He throws a party. They run out of red solo cups, and then they start drinking from the museum stuff that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Solomon's temple and palace. And that's when he sees the writing on the wall. Meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin. You've been weighed and found wanting. And the Bible says his knees smote one against the other and his bowels were loosed. That's 539. That's when King Cyrus is going to take over. This is what's called an absolute monarchy. Verse 39. But after you shall rise another kingdom, inferior, not quite as imposing as yours. Go. That's going to be the Medo-Persian Empire. That's Cyrus the Great. Cyrus the Great is a Persian. But at first, he needs the Medes, the great culture and society. By the way, there's still a remnant of the Medes left roughly in the same area, northern Iraq and eastern Syria. And they're called the Kurds, if you've heard of that. They're descendants of the Medes. So the Medo-Persian Empire, that's where you're going to have two arms. But eventually, Cyrus the Great is going to overtake them all. So from 539 B.C. to 332 B.C., Cyrus the Great unites two great nations. That's why the two arms. Then another, a third kingdom of bronze shall rule over all the earth. Go. That's going to be the Greek Empire. That's Alexander the Great. That's 332 B.C. to 168 B.C. It's the Battle of Issus in 333 B.C. that Alexander the Great defeats the last of the Persian army, and then his four generals, Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemaeus, and Seleucus, go with him. Now verse 40. And there's a fourth kingdom coming. It shall be strong as iron, insomuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom is going to break into pieces and crush all the others. Go. This is Rome, but more specifically, Rome A, if you will, or Rome, Roman numeral 1. That's Julius Caesar et al., and that's from 168 B.C. to A.D. 476. That's a date that is largely regarded as Rome was never fully conquered. It more or less fell apart from the inside. It splits in two, remember? Constantine, he wins the seat of the empire, but he says, it's not going well here in the West. I'm picking up the capital of Rome, and I'm moving it east to Istanbul, which is today Istanbul. And then it was actually called Byzantium, but he changes the name to Constantinople. So in the east, the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, is going to last for 1,000 years. In the west, it's only going to last until about 476. Real quickly, 45 BC is when Julius Caesar outplays Pompey and the other generals, and then the Senate bestows upon him the title Pontius Maximus, or Eternal Dictator, and he is considered the first Caesar. Verse 41. Now, there's more coming about that beast. Verse 41. Now, whereas you saw the feet and toes, you remember that? Yeah, I get that. By the way, two legs of that statue there, because that would be the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay, partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. Verse 42. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. Verse 43. As you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. Go. Now he's speaking of a fifth incarnation or an empire. We're going to call this Rome B, or Rome, Roman numeral 2. Rome never really was conquered in the West, in Europe. It fell apart. It sort of waned and got dry and just sort of crumbled. The Bible makes a very startling prediction and Bible prophecy that Rome will be reconstituted again in the last days. Real quickly, after the Second World War in Europe, and where they got tatered, all of these individual European countries, European leaders knew that they could never let that happen ever again. So the royal families, because the Habsburgs and the Romanovs were all intermarried and had kings in all of these other European nations. So they got everybody together, and they knew that they would have to work toward unity. Most attempts politically had failed, but then somebody hatched upon a great idea. I know, let's do it economically first, and let's start with heavy industry. Real quickly, in chapter 2, the four metals of how humans see their precious empires. But in chapter 7, we're going to see the same four, five, empires, but they're not going to be metals. They're going to be ravenous beasts. Go ahead, Chris. And so when we get to chapter 7, we'll see these animals. We'll see a lion with eagle's wings, and we're going to explain that that is so Babylon. And then we're going to see a bear, a great big lumbering bear. And he starts with two, and it's going to be the one. That's the Medo-Persian. King Cyrus would travel with an army upwards of 1 million dudes. But then you're going to have that leopard. He's very light, like wings. He's going to have four wings, actually. And he's going to be going so fast, he barely touches the ground. When Alexander the Great traveled and conquered most of the known world, he did so with less than 150,000 troops. Lightning fast. And if you know your history, in the history of military conquest, Blitzkrieg that was hatched by Hitler and his generals was taking a page of lightning fast, but instead of cavalry, we will use mechanized machines and infantry and move troops around at lightning speed. The Nazis borrowed a page from Alexander the Great's lightning fast methodology, and they called it Blitzkrieg. And then that last one, that one's tough. It's so nasty that there's no animal, it seems, under the sun, which adequately sort of describes it. So he just calls it an exceedingly dreadful and terrible beast. We're going to see that in chapter 7. Go ahead, Chris. Let's go back to what we're talking about here. This is an important picture, you guys. Back to this understanding of this fourth beast, or really Rome B. Rome was never fully wiped out by a conquest of another nation. They just dissipated. After World War II, the heads of the European countries were realizing we need to come together. And here's how we'll do it. We'll start with heavy industry. And in 1951, this is called the Treaty of Paris. It was signed by six European countries. And it created this, the European coal and steel industry. That's 1951 when they signed it. But guess when they drafted the framework of what will become the European Union? The year was 1948. Israel is born. What else is born? The seeds of what will become Rome B. 1959, they finally got everybody together and they signed it. Then there was another treaty a couple years later, 1957, and that created the European Atomic Energy Committee. Cool. And then another one created the European Economic Community. And then in 1951, another Treaty of Paris created the European Economic Community Parliament, where not elected officials, but appointed officials from all of these nations in Europe, and they come to a grand parliament setting where they're going to start talking about laws. And they started talking about a supranational governing body that would someday have the power to coalesce all the nations of Europe. This is what they're going for. 1967, July, commissions of the Atomic Energy Community, Economic Community combined, forming an entirely new entity called the European Economic Community, or as all of Europe calls it, the European Unity, the European Union, pardon me. 1973, it's really working well. They're combining a lot of their economic ability and marketing and transportation of goods. Denmark, Greece, Ireland, and the UK. Hey, can we join? They did. Now there are 10. Soon after, Spain and Portugal. There's 12. Currently, there are 27 European Union nations. Go ahead. And this is what's fascinating to me. There's the Roman Empire. The Bible makes a startling prophecy. Rome will rise again. There's Rome, go. And here is the economic community, the European Union. And as you can see, there are people that are waiting to get on board. Of course, Brexit took UK out for a while. 2001, all currency among the EU is changed. So the French franc is gone. The German mark is gone. And now we're going to have the euro. And in 2016, of course, Brexit. Go. I want to show you inside the Parliament building there in Brussels, Belgium. That's what it looks like. You guys, that is the Washington, D.C. of the European Union. That's the inside. Go. Here's the outside of it. Many of you have seen me feature this building before. And I want you to notice, looks like it's not finished. Is it just me? But this was deliberately done by the architect to mirror and match this. Go. This is a poster that actually is sort of copying a classic Peter Bruegel, 1553, in his oil painting called The Tower of Babel. This poster showed up in the early 90s when EU was getting really going with a lot of traction. And notice they say, Europe, many tongues, one voice. And they literally on their poster, they wanted to copy in artistic form Peter Bruegel's picture or painting of the Tower of Babel. Who engineered and started the Tower of Babel? Nimrod did. Jerusalem is God's city. Is there an anti-city, a devil city? It's Babylon, and it's going to come back. Go ahead. This is a sculpture out in the front. I've showed you this before. This is a woman riding a beast. And I know that it actually is Europa. That's a human chick. And there is a Zeus who turned himself into a bull. And he saw her on the shore. And she was pretty good looking. So he rolls up in the form of a bull and says, "Hey, let's go. Hop on." And by the way, ladies, if a bull ever shows up on the shore, don't jump on his back. Don't go with him. Didn't work out too well for Europa. But anyway, that's what it is. Hold your finger here, and if you will indulge me with that image up, Revelation chapter 17, please, quickly. Revelation 17, and with that picture up, it always gives me a little bit of Holy Ghost chill bumps. Revelation 17. Revelation 17, look at verse 3. Everybody got it? "So he carried me, John, away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet." She was very rich, very wealthy. By the way, who this is, the harlot, this is when the church gets raptured, the Antichrist is going to try to get everybody to worship effectively in the same direction. A huge ecumenical tidal wave is going to sweep up the post-rapture world. And it would seem that the Islamics and the Christians, quote-unquote, and all the religions are going to come together, and that's who this woman represents. Verse 5, "On her forehead was the name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth." Yeah, I know that's Europa and the bull, but that's in front of the parliament in Brussels, Belgium, of the European Union. Go to the next picture, if you would. There's the currency, there's the euro. I want you to notice that those are buildings and various other depictions, but they're not real buildings that actually exist. A culture's money and the portraits that are on. Think of American dollar, that's George Washington, the $5, Lincoln, the $100, Benjamin Franklin, et cetera, et cetera. Are those people important to who we are as a nation and as a culture? Yeah. The European Union, the euro, takes away all of the individualization of the nations because they want all of them pulling in the same direction. That's why you see a building and a this and a that. But there's no actual people involved in that. It's deliberate to take the nationality out of it. Okay. Now what about this 10 toes? And these are going to be 10 regions. Hit the go button. I showed you the European Union. And the Bible says very clearly, not just here in Daniel chapter 2, but in a couple of other locations, we're going to see that the Antichrist, we're going to get to chapter 7 and following, we're going to see that when the Antichrist shows up, there the entire planet is being broken up into 10 regions, each with a centralized governmental system of some kind. The Antichrist, the little horn, he is going to uproot 3 others, and he is going to control, effectively then, all 10 regions. The Bible is making quite a prediction that when the Antichrist does his thing, especially when he gets started, there will be 10 governmental regions in all of planet Earth. Currently, there are 197 nations. How is it possible? I want to show you something if you weren't familiar. I've showed you the economic, pardon me, the European Union. It has its own parliament. It has its anthem, Ode to Joy. They're working on a military. They have a supranational setting. Everything is in place, and if somebody sailed into that number one position of the European Union, the structure is in place to literally take control of Europe itself. It's there. Are there any other European Union type activities? I'm glad you asked. Go ahead, Chris, let's show them. Yep, there sure are. You see, the African Union was started in the year 2002. It has a capital as well. It has a capital building in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The Union of South American Nations was started in 2008. Its capital is Brasilia, Brazil. The Asian Cooperative started in 1989. It has its capital in Singapore. South Asia Free Trade Association. Do you see that everybody was looking at the European Union and seeing all of these nations coalescing together, joining in gross national product, etc., that their economic power was multiplied manyfold? Well, then many other groups started to do the same thing. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations started 1967. It has a capital too, Jakarta, Indonesia. The Pacific Island Forum was started in 1971. Its capital, Suva, Fiji. Go. There's more. The Eurasian Economic Community. That's Moscow with its capital. It's lost a little steam, as you might imagine. But it was begun in the year 2000. Then you have the Greater Arab Free Trade Association, started in 1998. It has its capital in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And then it's not such a big deal now, but under George Herbert Walker Bush, NAFTA, North American Free Trade Association. There's no capital per se. We're not nearly as far along as these others. But I want you to notice something. Hit the go button. Currently, there is in place some more stronger than others. But currently, it is possible that the planet could be governed effectively from those 10 regions. How many of you didn't know that NAFTA had sort of that Canada, the United States and Mexico thing happening? It's really amazing. Some of those co-ops are a little stronger, as I said, than others. But it's fascinating to me that when you count them all up, there's 10 of them. Are those the 10 that the Antichrist is going to empower? I don't know. But I want you to see, at least in principle, that the nations of the planet have been thinking about it. And I believe the enemy is behind it, that when the time is right and the church is gone, planet Earth is going to be divided into 10 regions, those 10 toes. Let's scoot to the end, back to Daniel, verse 44. And in the days of these kings, Rome be, that's ahead of us, God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. That'll be the millennial reign of Christ. Remember, he's going to smash that big rock, Jesus, is going to smash the toes, and then that whole statue is going to fall over. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break into pieces and consume all of these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. That is the millennial reign of Christ. But this is Daniel telling Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 45. Insomuch as you saw the stone that was cut on the mountain without hands, and that it broke into pieces the iron and the bronze and the clay and the silver and the gold, the great God has made known to the king, you, Nebuchadnezzar, what's going to happen, what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and the interpretation is sure. King Nebuchadnezzar, you did it! That's right! And Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering, an incense to him. Daniel's going to be quick. No, no, this supernatural knowledge didn't come from me. Verse 47. The king answered Daniel and said, truly your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and the revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. He's very, very impressed. And I wrote in my margin, he is wowed by God. He is impressed by God's obvious move, but he is not yet converted. It is a thing in many churches where they want to move out in the spiritual gifts because the spiritual gifts are fun. And in many cases, when you see a healing, a bona fide medical miracle, It's very impressive. But please understand that those kind of signs, Jesus says, never really convert anyone. Here's an example. You're right, you totally read the thoughts of my heart. You told me my dream. I am so impressed. And look at his physical response. He falls down. I'm so impressed. Yay, Daniel's God. Rah, rah, rah. But he is not converted until after the events of chapter 4. Harvest, be careful. When you hear someone or even it rises within you, I'd like to go see what's happening over there because of all the spiritual coolnesses that are happening. It doesn't mean a thing. Fasting doesn't mean a thing if I'm not obedient to God's word. Well, what about all those signs and wonders at some of these meetings where there's obvious supernatural manifestations? Well, some of the manifestations I can't find in the book of Acts or in the Gospels, whether you're laughing uncontrollably, various other sort of expressions, but people flock to that. And there are these television evangelists who do a number of things that are very impressive for a second, but it doesn't mean a thing unless someone is converted from being crushed and overwhelmed by their sins. Overwhelmed by the goodness and holiness of God. That's conversion. So I want you to notice, boy, is he impressed, but he, Nebuchadnezzar, is still a knucklehead, you'll see. Verse 48. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. And remember, he saved their lives. What do you think their response is going to be? Verse 49. Also, Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. So now those Jerusalem boys are running the show. But Daniel sat at the gate of the king. How's this going to sit with the old guard? Not well. Next week, the lion's den.